listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart, and we have a lot to talk about this Monday. The media blames Donald Trump for the shooting at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland. Conservatives have weaponized the First Amendment. The New York Times believes so. Women are encouraged to talk about their abortion in order to protect abortion. But does that get to the heart of the debate? Then I have a conversation with Anna Anderson, the director of family policy with American Principles Project, about an important bill in the House, the Child Welfare Provider Inclusion Act. First, here's a word from Caffeinated Thoughts senior contributor Brian Myers about Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen of America, who can help you with your life insurance needs.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
Last Thursday, a gunman who shall remain nameless walked into the Gazette, Capitol Gazette, in Annapolis, Maryland, and opened fire, killing five journalists and wounding several others. We later learned that he carried an intense grudge against the newspaper for its accurate reporting on his criminal harassment conviction in 2011. After any shooting, hot takes are generally bad, and this one was no exception. And looking at some of the hot takes on Twitter from the media, who are obviously upset about losing colleagues in a shooting like this, which is understandable, the blame unfortunately wasn't directed at the gunman. It was directed at Donald Trump. Freelance journalist Lauren Duca, for instance, tweeted, quote, "The shooting today at the Capitol Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland, cannot reasonably be separated from the president's mission to villainize the press as the enemy of the American people," unquote. I agree that that phrase from the president is unfortunate. Referring to the press as the enemy of the American people is hyperbole. The only function it serves is basically to rile up his base, and it doesn't really do anything to help promote a civil discourse or change bias in the media. As a matter of fact, it probably stokes it further. Andrew Feinberg, who's a White House correspondent for Breakfast Media, I never heard of them before, but he's a credentialed reporter for the White House, or at the White House, tweeted to President Trump, "You caused this, Mr. President." Maggie Haberman of the New York Times said, quote, "Supporting local journalism is important. What happened today is sickening. This alleged gunman appears to have had a long-standing grudge against the paper and little else is known so far." I'm going to stop for a minute. If she stopped there, that would have been perfectly fine, but she didn't. Continuing, quote, "But Trump is the only president in memory to call the press the enemy of the people," unquote. Josh Meyer with Politico tweeted, responding to an NBC News tweet that quoted one of the reporters asking President Trump as he's walking away, "Can you please talk to us about the dead reporters in Annapolis?" A little context. He already gave a statement on the Annapolis shooting. Josh Meyer, an investigative reporter with Politico, tweeted, quote, "Every journalist and those who support us should retweet this. I can't think of a single other president in my lifetime who would have acted like this. Perhaps he fears questions about whether his anti-media rhetoric played a role," unquote. Rob Cox, an editor with Reuters, tweeted, "This is what happens when, at Real Donald Trump, calls journalists the enemy of the people. Blood is on your hands, Mr. President. Save your thoughts and prayers for your empty soul. At least four people killed in Maryland, newspaper shooting, reports, and he shares a link to the Reuters article about the shooting. He later deleted the tweet and apologized, which I'm glad he did. He should have never tweeted it to begin with. Now there's also been a shift from just not just blaming Trump, but then there's also a belief that's being conveyed that journalists should be beyond criticism. As a result, Jessica Huseman with ProPublica tweeted, quote, "This may have been a targeted shooting, but the whole country was willing to believe that this was an attack on journalism as a profession should tell you something, and that thing is not good," unquote. I'm not sure if the whole world or whole country was willing to believe that. I think a lot of us were waiting for facts to come out instead of just spouting off a hot take. Caitlin Collins with CNN tweeted, "I don't want to ever hear the phrase fake news again," unquote. Tom Marquette, former editor and publisher of Capital Gazette Communications, wrote an op-ed over at the Washington Post. He wrote, quote, "There was a time when a complaint was something to deposit in a box or take to a supervisor. If that failed, there was always the courts or a letter to the editor to air grievances. Now complaints are being dispatched without mercy down the barrel of a gun. How long could this carnage go on before we drop the rhetoric about guns and face what the nation is becoming? How does it take grieving high school students to speak for us to fill a moral vacuum created by a president who prefers to spend his time relentlessly and personally attacking anyone who dares to oppose him? President Trump isn't responsible for the Annapolis tragedy any more than the Second Amendment is, but he and his supporters seem to have forgotten that the Constitution that gives them the right to bear arms and the same document that safeguards the right to free speech, or is the same document that safeguards the right to free speech. You cannot honor one amendment without honoring the other 26. Those dedicated Capital Gazette journalists, like others before them, and surely others after them, fought for free speech at all costs, including death. It's not prayers their survivors and co-workers need. It's respect for what reporters and editors do every day," unquote. Again, this shooting had nothing to do with President Trump's recent criticism. And also, just because a newsroom was shot up does not mean criticism of the media should cease. Criticism should be fair, but if journalists want to be treated with respect, then be respectful and report the news fairly and accurately. If they do that, and I hope they do, then public perception about the profession should change, and I hope that it does. Is the First Amendment being weaponized? Well, Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, in her dissenting opinion in Janus v. AFSCME last week, wrote, quote, "The majority overthrows a decision entrenched in this nation's law and in its economic life for over 40 years. As a result, it prevents the American people, acting through their state and local officials, from making important choices about workplace governance, and it does so by weaponizing the First Amendment in a way that unleashes judges, now and in the future, to intervene in economic and regulatory policy," unquote. First of all, this case was not about economic regulatory policy, and I'm sorry, the First Amendment trumps that. But this particular case is about compelling government employees to have to pay for political speech they disagree with. Everything that public sector unions do is political. Even collective bargaining is political because they are bargaining for taxpayer money with government officials. Also, the money is fungible. The money that's spent or that's used from agency fees from non-union members can free up money to be spent for lobbying or political campaigns and endorsements. This is ultimately a First Amendment issue. No one should be coerced to pay for free speech they disagree with. As far as the argument that the First Amendment's being weaponized, apparently Adam Liptak believes that's the case as well. He wrote a front page story on the New York Times about this, referring to NIFLA via the NIFLA decision that ruled against California's Reproductive Fact Act and the Janus ruling. He wrote, quote, The two decisions were the latest in a stunning run of victories for a conservative agenda that has increasingly been built on the foundation of free speech. Conservative groups borrowing and building on arguments developed by liberals have used the First Amendment to justify unlimited campaign spending, discrimination against gay couples, and attacks on the regulation of tobacco, pharmaceuticals, and guns, unquote. This is a news piece. A news piece that was on the front page of the New York Times. This was not located in the opinion section. He then quotes Ilya Shapiro, who is a lawyer with the Cato Institute. Quote, the libertarian position has become dominant on the right on the First Amendment issues. It simply means that we should be skeptical of government attempts to regulate speech. That used to be an uncontroversial, non-ideological point. What's now being called a libertarian position on speech was in the 1960s a liberal position on speech, unquote. Liptak continues, quote, and an increasingly conservative judiciary has been more than a little receptive to this argument. A new analysis prepared for the New York Times found that the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., has been far more likely to embrace free speech arguments concerning conservative speech than liberal speech. That is a sharp break from earlier eras, unquote. In earlier eras, fewer cases of conservative speech being suppressed were handled by the Supreme Court. Lee Epstein and Andrew Martin and Kevin Quinn, who prepared this analysis for the Times, said, quote, a key finding is that the Roberts Court, more than any modern court, has trained its sights on speech promoting conservative values. Only the current court has resolved a higher fraction of disputes challenging the suppression of conservative rather than liberal expression, unquote. Well, okay, but then they say this, quote, the decline in the fraction is evident and statistically significant. With each passing era, the court heard fewer cases with expression aligned with liberal causes and, of course, many more involving conservative expression. Of the Warren Court, 60 cases, only 5 challenged suppression of conservative speech. Of the Roberts Courts, 40 cases, 26, nearly two-thirds, fell into the conservative category, unquote. Just a thought, but perhaps this is the case because government has not been suppressing liberal speech. I can't think of a recent case of this happening. Certainly nothing that's made the mainstream media. Also, perhaps this is the case that because conservatives, by and large, have become more libertarian of their view of free speech and largely do not want the government to interfere. Now, I understand that's not always been the case. And there's been times where liberal speech, especially in the 60s, during the whole 60s revolution that we saw and anti-war protests, that liberal speech was suppressed and the court rightly dealt with that. But we've also seen a shift. I think you're seeing a swing from one extreme to another. Now, conservative speech is, by and large, the one that's being suppressed. Liptak continues, quote, many on the left have traded an absolutist commitment to free speech for one sensitive to the harms it can inflict, unquote. He uses the example of the left in the past supporting the free speech rights of pornographers and the American Nazi Party. But they have now been woke to the dangers of both. Quote, some liberals now say that free speech disproportionately protects the powerful and the status quo, unquote. That's a remarkable statement. And then he quotes two law professors. Quote, when I was younger, I had more of the standard liberal view of civil liberty, said Louis Michael Seidman, a law professor at Georgetown, and I've gradually changed my mind about it. What have I come to see is that it's a mistake to think of free speech as an effective means to accomplish a more just society. To the contrary, free speech reinforces and amplifies injustice. Catherine A. McKinnon, a law professor at the University of Michigan, wrote in Free Speech Century, a collection of essays to be published later this year. She writes, once the defense of the powerless, the First Amendment over the last 100 years, has mainly become a weapon of the powerful. Legally, what was toward the beginning of the 20th century a shield for radicals, artists, and activists, socialists and pacifists, the excluded and the dispossessed, has become a sword for, or for authoritarians, racists and misogynists, Nazis and Klansmen, pornographers and corporations buying elections, unquote. So this explains why the left, who once championed free speech for all, now tries to suppress speech they disagree with. Notice how noble free speech, you know, when it was a shield, it was noble then, but now when it's speech they disagree with, now it's a sword. You know, the best way to combat bad speech is not to suppress it at all, but to fight it with better speech. If fighting off the suppression of free speech means weaponizing the First Amendment, so be it. Cindy Leib, the former editor-in-chief of Glamour and Self, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, published also on Saturday, entitled, "Let's Talk About My Abortion and Yours." Lamenting the retirement of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy and what that might mean for the Roe v. Wade decision in the future, she wrote, "But it would be quite so easy to demonize the common experience if it were clear that women who have gone through it, include it being abortion, include kindergarten teachers, clergywomen, Republicans, CEOs, the woman who served your coffee this morning, who cleans your house, who signs your paycheck, who patrols your neighborhood. As the activist Renee Bracey Sherman, who runs the We Testify site, put it, quote, everyone loves someone who has had an abortion, and if you think you don't, they just haven't shared their story with you yet, unquote. She continues. She writes, silence also allows menacing myths about abortion to thrive. Most Americans believe the procedure to be less common than it is and more dangerous. No wonder, according to one study on television, 5% of the female characters who chose abortion die, a figure that is 7,000 times the actual very low real-life mortality rate. As for the popular perception that women regret their abortions, 95% of those women who end their pregnancy say they believe they made the right decision. Oh, and the stereotype that women who get abortions are selfish and unmaternal? Well, the majority already have one child, studies show. But for a young woman faced with an unplanned pregnancy, those are terrifying misperceptions to contend with," unquote. Her studies aside, the statistics aside, probably getting that information from the Guttenmach, I think that's how you pronounce it, Guttenmach, Institute, which is a research arm of Planned Parenthood. You know, the stats are probably sketchy, but setting that aside, her piece neglects something vitally important. She does not talk about the life of the child that is aborted. Who has had an abortion does not matter. It still takes the life of a child. Whether a woman feels like they made the right decision doesn't matter. I'm sure the unborn child would disagree. Regardless of how many women die from abortion, the simple fact is this. There is an almost 100% mortality rate for the unborn child. We need to remember that the abortion debate is ultimately about this. When does life begin? If taking innocent life is wrong and life begins at conception, there is no excuse, no narrative, no experience that would justify it. The debate over Roe v. Wade is whether unborn babies have the same right to life articulated in the 5th and 14th Amendments as persons. The Declaration of Independence declares that the right to life is an inalienable right. The left wants to make it all about the mother, but those of us who are pro-life speak on behalf of those who don't have a voice. Next, I had a conversation last Friday with Anna Anderson, the Director of Family Policy with American Principles Project, and we discussed the Child Welfare Provider Inclusion Act, H.R. 1881, that's sponsored by Congressman Mike Kelly out of Pennsylvania. Before I get to that conversation, first, a word from American Principles Project, who have been a sponsor of this podcast since it launched last October.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles, such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Hey, Anna, thank you so much for taking time to talk with our listeners. A problem that I think exists that maybe a lot of our listeners don't realize is that adoption agencies are facing an assault from those who are pushing the LGBTQ agenda. What have you seen, as far as this problem, and how is it impacting adoption agencies across the nation?
Thanks for having me on, Shane. Yes, that is really where the push against religious freedom is going now, in the conflict between religious freedom and LGBT rights. And in recent months, and now just the other day with the NIFLA pro-life pregnancy center case, the Supreme Court has actually issued several decisions rebuking the government for discriminating against people of faith. And now the court has to keep reiterating what it's already said loud and clear, that religious freedom is not confined to a worship service. Religious people have the right to live out their faith in all areas of life. And, that's why our society is so strong, that the government is not the only one doing charity. It's basically, you don't want DMV of adoption agencies. So it's very important that we have religious people working in the adoption and foster care space. There's been several lawsuits actually that have sprung up in recent years, especially in response to the laws that are causing Catholic and also evangelical adoption agencies to shut down. So specifically, right after Boston redefined marriage, Massachusetts shut down their Catholic charities because of the policy change, saying that their choice to place children specifically with mother, father, family homes was discriminatory on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And we saw the same thing happen in San Francisco, in Illinois, and also Washington, D.C.
Okay. Any other states that have these laws in the books that could potentially impact adoption agencies?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Washington, Oregon, California, New York. There's quite a few states, actually, that have these. They're called sexual orientation and gender identity laws, which basically alters current existing non-discrimination law, which was originally designed and intended to protect people of race or women in many cases from discrimination. And yet the activists are just tacking on the term sexual orientation and gender identity to this already existing law, which was created for a very different problem, to fix very different problems.
Right.
And that's where you're getting these conflicts over religious freedom.
I know Iowa has sexual orientation and gender identity added to the Iowa Civil Rights Code. I personally have not heard of any issues with adoption agencies. That doesn't mean they don't exist. It's just that they haven't necessarily been publicized, or maybe a complaint hasn't been made yet. So that's
right. Well, and in many cases, it's actually just when the left decides to target these agencies. So one of the lawsuits that's sprung up right now is in Michigan. The ACLU is suing because Michigan actually has a law that would protect religious adoption agencies from this. It was a response to these other adoption agencies being shut down. And so the ACLU is suing over this, but their plaintiffs, which is the lesbian couple who had gone to a Christian adoption agency to try to adopt before they were turned down, actually drove past four different state or other private agencies
Right.
that would have allowed them to adopt, absolutely no problem. And the Christian Adoption Agency actually referred them to some of these other agencies. So it's looking like the left is actually specifically targeting
yeah.
agencies when they have these laws that they can prosecute under.
Yeah, because, you know, we've seen that in a number of cases with, you know, obviously with any, with Jack Phillips and Baronelle Stutzman. I mean, obviously there are plenty of other bakers who could make a wedding cake and plenty of other florists that, you know, they wouldn't care whether it's a same-sex wedding or not. They would be willing to provide services for that. But yeah, let's go ask the Christian bakers, the florists, and the Christian agencies to basically jettison what we believe to be true about marriage and family in order to provide a service for you.
Right. Yep, exactly.
So you guys are working to push a bill called the Child Welfare Provider Inclusion Act, which I believe is H.R. 1881. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of that bill and what it does?
Yeah, so the bill is being currently sponsored in the House and the Senate. And as of just a few days ago, it is now officially a bipartisan bill.
Okay.
We do have a Democrat sponsor as well.
Wow.
yeah, we do. Yeah, which is, I mean, and it should be. It should be a bipartisan bill because the only people who lose out in this situation are the kids.
Right.
Who lose the chance at having another service actually trying to find them their forever homes.
Yeah. So let's give this guy credit. Who's the Democrat that joined on?
It's Colin Pearson.
Okay. He's from our neighbor to the north, okay, Minnesota 7th Congressional District, I believe. So, good for him. Any other Democrats you think would be open to this?
I can't say. I don't know, actually. but it would be fantastic. So, if you have, or any of your listeners have Democratic representatives who would be willing to stand up for the rights of families and kids and religious organizations, you should let them know that that is a priority for you. Because the more Democrats that we have who are willing to take a stand on this, the stronger it makes our case.
Definitely. So who from Iowa is co-sponsoring? And I want to get into the nuts and bolts of the bill, but anyone from Iowa co-sponsor?
From Iowa, we do have Steve King.
All right, good for him. Which does not surprise me that he would jump on that. So
no, definitely not.
We need to, our listeners need to reach out to Congressman David Young and Congressman Rod Blum. And then, well, we could also reach out to Dave Loebsack as well, even though I'm not going to hold my breath that he would be convinced to co-sponsor this. But hey, you know, squeaky wheel gets the grease, right?
Yes, exactly. No, that is the right attitude to have. And unfortunately, conservatives are often a little too quiet on these issues when they come up. And this is definitely a bill that we want the full force behind because it is extremely necessary and comes at a crossroads, really, for religious freedom right now.
Okay, so what does the bill actually do?
Yeah, so the bill basically says that the government cannot discriminate against religious adoption agencies or adoption and foster care agencies that choose to place children with a married mother and father. And basically what it says is that the federal government can withhold 15% of a family services funds if a state or local government is discriminating in this way. So it's definitely a very good incentive for states to apply the law equally to their adoption providers, which we haven't seen. And largely, I think it has arisen in response to what happened in Philadelphia recently. A lot of these other cases, Illinois, Massachusetts, D.C., those adoption agencies were shut down a while ago, and I think the urgency of what was happening kind of got lost. But just a few months ago, we saw the city of Philadelphia say, oh, we just realized that Catholic Charities and Bethany Christian Services, which are the two Christian adoption agencies which would fall under this category of agencies that place only with married moms and dads, we think that's discriminatory. And so they actually revoked their contracts. So they were allowed to keep the kids who they already had in their custody, who they were serving. But they were told, we're not going to contract with you anymore to be able to assist families in Philadelphia.
And, wow, way to think of the kids there.
Yeah, exactly. No, these laws and what these state and local governments are doing do nothing to help find kids' homes. They do nothing to help find more foster and adoption families. They only limit what other people can do to help. They only limit the number of people and actually the amount of private funds that are going into recruiting and finding families for adoption and foster care. And the fact is, these religious agencies actually have an extremely high success rate
right.
at finding families for older or hard-to-place children, which is the majority of kids who are in our foster and adoption system right now.
Right.
A lot of people want to adopt a baby.
Yeah.
You know, they're cute and they're cuddly, but there's not a lot of people who want to take in a boy who's been trapped in the foster care system for years now, who might have, you know, behavioral issues, or, you know, we've had actually a huge influx of kids into the adoption and foster care system in the wake of the opioid crisis. And so to say that we're going to eliminate providers who are helping find families for these kids at a time when we have more kids needing loving homes than ever is absolutely egregious.
Right. And it just, and it makes absolutely no sense considering there are agencies that have no qualms about placing these kids with a same sex couple. So yeah, let's just eliminate the ones that do, who probably, you know, probably have a wider net, I would think. Cause I know in Iowa, probably Bethany Christian Services and Catholic Charities are probably two of the largest and probably place the most kids into adoptive families in Iowa. So if they were to suddenly go away, I can't even imagine that. So yeah, and you're right as far as, you know, finding families with kids that are older. I worked with System Youth for 13 years, and yeah, everybody wants to adopt a baby, but the kid that, you know, maybe has attachment issues, who, you know, who's a junior high kid, that's not quite as attractive. So we definitely need these
agents. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we need these agents out there.
Yeah, nationwide, you know, 45% of the adoptions that Catholic Charities actually places and 32% of what Bethany Christian Services does are special needs or hard to place children. So that's a huge chunk of the services that they're actually offering.
Okay. So what momentum are you seeing getting this bill moving through the legislative process?
There has definitely been some. We were recently able to partner with AFA, American Family Association, to put out a call to action. And we picked up a few co-sponsors that way. We're also hoping that President Trump will take this up as an issue as the opioid crisis is actually addressed. And so because this is both a pro-life priority as well as a religious freedom priority and is key to addressing a lot of the fallout from the opioid crisis. So who knows when that'll happen with the immigration debate going on right now. But once we get back down to discussing these sorts of issues, it'll definitely, we hope to push it to the forefront of the conversation. And as we approach midterms, you know, this is an extremely important bill for Democrats who might be in a Trump voting district, considering this is actually one of Trump's priorities. And especially, like, it's a great, great bill for congresspeople to take up if they are in a conservative district, because this is just really a win-win bill for families and for children.
So beyond contacting their member of Congress, and do you happen to have the bill number in the Senate?
I can actually get that 1 second.
Okay. So yeah, I want to make sure that our listeners have the numbers when they call their our senators, Joni Ernst and Grassley. I meant to ask you too, who's kind of behind pushing the bill in the Senate?
Yeah, well, our main sponsor is Enzi.
Okay.
Mike Enzi. And it's definitely been a little more stalled in the Senate. That's for sure. We don't have as many co-sponsors.
Okay. So we need to get on Senators Ernst and Grassley then. Yep. Okay, definitely. So beyond contacting our members of Congress and our senators, anything else can be done to help remedy this problem? Anything going on at the state level to address this?
Yes, there are some states that have taken up just local legislation similar to this bill. Kansas recently passed a bill, Oklahoma. And so it'd be extremely helpful to check and see if a bill like this is up for consideration in your state and provide your support for that bill. Similar bills have been passed in Texas, Michigan, Minnesota, North Dakota, Virginia, and Maryland have both passed them. Alabama and Mississippi. I don't believe Iowa has passed.
Which has been kind of maddening, because we have a Republican House and Republican Senate and a Republican governor that we have not been able to get anything significant done on religious liberty issues, especially as it pertains to kind of putting up a hedge against the LGBT agenda. I think big business has a lot to do with that. I'm sure that's probably, you've seen resistance in other states. I know Georgia in particular had a huge pushback from corporate America on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And yeah. I think we have the same, similar dynamics going on as well. So definitely it'll be something I want to see pushed here in Iowa, and hopefully we can work with some legislators and get a bill going on that.
Yeah, and if you haven't had any controversies specifically in Iowa, that's not a reason to not address this issue now.
Because right,
you never know when the next lawsuit is coming, when you have a city like Philadelphia that just up and decides to remove contracts from your adoption providers.
Yeah, definitely don't want to wait till an agency shuts down before we address the problem. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and I would tell your viewers too, especially when they're contacting Congress people, the pushback you're probably going to get on this bill is from LGBT activists who say that it is a discriminatory bill. And in reality, it's the exact opposite.
Right.
And it's very important to let your Congress people know that this bill does nothing to restrict adoptions to LGBT couples. It does, and even the federal bill does nothing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really just a non-point. All of these agencies serve children, no matter what their sexual orientation or gender identity. They have no qualms about giving the same loving care and priority on placement with these children that they do to any other child. They just have a view about what exactly is the best home situation to put these kids in. And social science backs that up, that kids do the best with a married mom and dad. We've known that for decades. And all this bill does is allow them to continue serving children and families like they always have.
Great. Well, hey, Anna, thank you so much for your time. And those who are listening, we'll have a link up to the, I believe AFA's got a voter voice process where you can contact legislators. We'll also have relevant phone numbers up for at least the Iowa delegation. So thank you so much for your time and talking with us about this bill. We appreciate it.
Great. No problem. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Hey, take care.
You too.
Bye. Bye.
That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please make sure you go check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's Caffeinated Thoughts, that's C-A-F-F-E-I-N-A-T-E-D, caffeinatedthoughts.com. Or Google Caffeinated Thoughts and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our emails so you don't miss a single article. You can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Please be sure to give us a 5-star rating if you do. You can also listen on Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. If you're not a subscriber, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a free episode. And you can listen using your favorite podcast app, and it's absolutely free. Until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care. Thank you.